No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That's Sweet Honey and the Rock. And this is Maria Sanchez. And our host, Senator Michael D. Brown, is unavailable to join us today because he's in Portugal addressing folks about the District of Columbia and disenfranchisement and the search for statehood and all the great things that he does with his day job. And then we meet here every week on BBS Radio with the program entitled Shadow Politics. And it is an hour-long grassroots program that used to be devoted specifically to talking about the District of Columbia and their struggle for statehood. But now we also do politics, newsmakers, lifestyle, health, wellness, relationships, and usually a lot of politics. So my name again is Maria Sanchez, and we want to thank you so much for making the time to visit with us and to make us a part of your week. And we're real pleased to have Dr. John Huber with us as our guest. Dr. Huber is a clinical forensic psychologist, and we're going to be speaking mostly today about the Golden State Killer, Joseph James DeAngelo. So Dr. Huber, welcome to the program, and thank you again for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on. I'm excited to be here.
And I know you had a circuitous kind of journey to get to where you are today as a clinical forensic psychologist. Would you share with our listeners the path that you took, which was not necessarily, quote, the ordinary normal path, which is much like what I'm doing, but a little bit later than you did, and then what it means to be a clinical forensic psychologist?
Okay. Well, I originally started my mental health career as a school psychologist, and I did that for several years. And one of the things having to do with schools, and you write reports and you make changes to people's education plan. And when things don't go right, you know, there's oftentimes judges and juries and stuff involved. So you have to be versed in the law as far as special education is concerned. And at that point, I kind of fell in love with that nuance of the legal part. And I knew I didn't want to be an attorney. So I started doing some discovery, and I found this small part of psychology called forensic psychology, where you go in and you get trained to deal with not just academic law, but also criminal law, civil law, as far as like divorces and child custody, and things like insanity defenses and competency to stand trial and special niche areas, one of which that we do here in where I'm at in Austin, Texas, in Travis County, is we do oftentimes risk assessment, where we assess somebody and give that information back to the judge about whether they're appropriate, for example, for parole, or if they're too violent and we need to make sure they stay in jail, that type of thing. And in fact, just recently, we had a federal case where we had a young man who, at the age of 16, was involved in a carjacking and a double homicide. And there were five other people there involved, all of which, except for four of them, were adults. And he got life without parole, where three of the other people are already out of jail. And he's now 35 years old. And it was brought to the attention of the Supreme Court, and maybe his rights might have been violated. And so we retried his sentencing phase using mitigating information that was not brought up previously. And he's actually looking forward to being eligible for parole here in a few years now. So we did win that case. So
what kind of training did you get in between your educations, and what kind of degrees did you get?
All right. So the first thing, I got my bachelor's degree. You need to have kind of a grounding in psychology or a social science. It doesn't have to be psychology to go on into training in master's and specialists, and also PhD level work as a psychologist or social worker. The time that was going on then, in the state of Texas, there were some issues with licensure requirements and things like that. So I got a what any other state would call a specialist degree in psychology, which is most masters are about 2 years and most PhDs are 4 or 5 years and then internships for both of those. But the specialist is 3 years. So it's right in between the master's and the doctorate degree. And the state of Texas still only recognizes that as a master's degree. So I've got a master's degree, which is a 3 year master's degree, plus my 2000 hour internship, internship before I actually graduated and got licensed. Then I worked as a school psychologist, like I said, for a few years and was always going back and forth to court and having a good experience there. Went back to school, got my master's degree on my way to my doctorate degree. So I have a second master's degree, and then I have my clinical psychology degree with my my specialty, my area of specialized training in forensics as opposed to child psychology or geriatric psychology and that type of thing. So I am a clinical forensic psychologist by training and by the rules set forth by the state of Texas. As far as that's concerned, I have to have specialized community or continuing education every year and things like that to keep that status.
So is your doctorate degree in clinical psychology?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. It is in clinical psychology with the specialization in forensics.
And thus, that's why you call yourself a psychologist?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So people exactly. always, we're similar here in California with what the state, how they delineate. And a lot of people forget that a psychiatrist is a medical doctor who went to medical school, whereas a psychologist, which I always say, I don't know, can you prescribe meds in Texas as a psychologist?
We're getting close, but we're not there yet.
Okay.
And actually,
in California.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of responsibility, I think. I'm all for it if it's warranted and necessary, but I really like it that somebody else has to do it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There are several states that have had it. And to this day, there has yet to be a malpractice lawsuit because of a psychologist prescribing psychotropic medications.
Interesting, because as they say, we deal with the person with the problems and the challenges, and then they deal with the prescriptions and not necessarily the therapy that goes into, you know, helping people get well or better or what have you. Before we get into the Golden State Killer, I'm curious, the responsibility that is on your shoulders with everything you do sounds enormous. How do you handle that?
Well, you know, you have to take care of yourself, and that's very important. If you can't take care of yourself and keep yourself sharp, you're not going to be able to help anybody else. That includes your family, your spouse, your children, not just your patients. And what I do is I have a close network of peers, other psychologists, people that I work with on a regular basis, and actually an attorney or two that have become friends because I've worked with them so long over the years. And they're good sounding boards, and it's kind of interesting that that's the case. But then I do physical exercise.
Dr. Huber, we lost you.
You lost me. I'm sorry. Yes. So I do martial arts, and I do that 3 to 6 hours a week, and that's a good way to let off steam. So I do that as well too.
So what Dr. Huber is referring to is known as self-care. And it goes right back to the first statement you made, that if you can't take care of yourself, you're of no value to others. And you must budget that time in your week, just like you budget anything else. Because if you fall last, then there's going to be fallout for all those concerned, including, as you mentioned, your personal relationships, let alone those of your clients and your patients. I was just thinking about when you talked about eligible for parole or too violent to be released or those kinds of assessments that you do, why wouldn't the person, the convict, do everything they could to charm you and to disarm you and to tell you what you want to hear so that they can have a favorable result?
Well, they do. I mean, that's part of what we cut through. You know, that is exactly. And if you're talking about a good sociopath, or psychopath, their terms are essentially interchangeable. That one of them's just dated. It's an old term, but everybody uses it. I walk into one courtroom. The judge says sociopath. The next courtroom, the judge says psychopath. They're interchangeable as far as I'm concerned at this point. But they do charm you. They're very good. That's how they are able to access their victims. They have that great charisma. You feel like you've known them your whole life, but when you walk away from them, you know absolutely nothing about that individual. That's the difference between somebody who is just a great person with great charisma. You know something about them when they leave as well. So it's not just one-sided. So
speaking of, let's go into Joseph James DeAngelo. And I'm curious, I know that it's not professionally appropriate to diagnose somebody that we haven't met in person. So I'm not asking you to do that. But if you, excellent, based on what you have gleaned from the cruelty and the pathology and everything else that went into his crimes, what would you think that you might surmise is his diagnosis?
More than likely, he would come across as a psychopath, a sociopath, definitely. And the diagnosis that we would see, for example, on the MMPI is not psychopath. It's actually antisocial personality disorder. But that's a very vague diagnosis. It includes actually some people who are just alcoholics, and the alcohol makes them, you know, chase people away to something as extreme as a serial killer or serial rapist. So,
because in reading through, so he was known as the Golden State Killer, the East Area Rapist, the Original Night Stalker, and also the Visalia Ransacker. And to date, I guess he's been, they must think that it's 12 murders, 45 rapes, and up to 150 burglaries. But what I'm curious about is, it was in a 10-year period from 1976 to 1986. And then even though he made, which I didn't know until I did a little research, he continued to make calls to his previous victims threatening to kill them all the way into the year 2001. So he was actively still threatening and stalking them, even though he had stopped his crime spree per se. What do you think about all of that?
Well, I mean, it's unusual that a serial killer lasts that long. Now, with a few exceptions, for example, female serial killers go for decades, and they tend to kill very slowly and methodically over time, whereas men tend to be much more violent, obviously. In this case, that's true with the rapes and everything else, and they tend to almost burn themselves out. They go for, you know, maybe 3 to 5 years. With a few exceptions, John Wayne Gacy, even the Green River Killer, and now the Golden State Killer that we have here.
And the fact that it escalated from the burglaries to the assaults, then to murder, do you see that as a reasonable progression of behavior?
You know, I think it is. You've got a lot of other mitigating things going on here. He was a police officer, which gave him access to court documents, to investigations. And I think by going through and trying with a lower type of violent situation, burglaries, and then moving up, he could kind of practice his techniques of getting in the way of the investigations without people seeing that. And I think that is kind of telling as far as the intellect of this person and how his thought process works. Again, I have not assessed him, but I would love to get the opportunity to sit down and meet with him for half an hour.
I bet. And what kind of defense do you think that he could bring up?
Wow. I have to see the evidence at this point, you know, and I'm not an attorney, but I have, you know, been in court several times, and, you know, everybody's different. And each case is different. There may be a weakness somewhere in the whole investigation and how they processed everything. He may have been, you know, the evidence may have been collected inappropriately. Now they got his DNA from his trash can, I understand, which is public domain. So there's nothing there that he can go after. But somewhere along the lines, there might have been a technical flaw. And that's what I would probably be looking at, because they've got a DNA connection. It's more than six alleles. Six alleles means it's a first blood relative or you. So it could be your children, your parents, that type of thing. But when it's more than that, it's isolated usually to the individual. So
and
that's something to think about.
Been a source of conversation in my peer circles that the DNA was obtained from one of those genealogy sites where you give your saliva.
Really?
Yes. And it wasn't like 23andMe or one of the bigger ones. It's this free one. And that's how they got it. So people are joking in my community, like, yeah, I don't really want to know what's going up my family tree. I might just keep my DNA to myself. How important.
Well,
is that
I recommend to people not to do that because of that very specific thing, but how it pertains to information that the insurance companies use, like for your life insurance policies and things like that. I think you have a right to let them know what is actually going on with you and not them getting it behind the scenes kind of thing. So I don't like those sites. And unless it's being done in a hospital where you've actually got full enforcement of all your HIPAA rights involved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I recommend it being done, with the exception of I do believe that the DNA testing for psychotropic medications, I've seen it work miracles for patients that we haven't been able to find the right medication for. And we do the DNA testing and we get a recommendation from the laboratory. And every time we've used it, it has changed that person's life for the better.
Can you go into more detail about that? Because I don't think the listeners quite understand the science involved with that. Because in general, what we know about psychiatrists prescribing is it's kind of a tinker. If this doesn't work for 3 to 6 months, then we're going to adjust, or
yes,
we're going to increase,
yes,
or we're going to substitute, or we're going to titrate, or what have you. But what you're saying sounds a lot more scientific than just that, let's try this approach.
Exactly. What they've done is they've looked at the human genome. And based on the human genome, they can tell, for example, if you have a good quality neuroreceptor sites for serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, that type of state areas, and then where the weaknesses are, where you don't quite have enough, or where you may be deficient in production of certain neurotransmitters. So if all of a sudden you start having the behavioral side of depression, the thing that you can do is go to these websites, and it's real easy. I'm not going to recommend any of them at this point, but I have used the two major ones with my clients. What you do is just Google DNA testing for psychotropics, and you will see the companies that do this. They send you a little swab, and you swipe the inside of your cheek. You put it in the seal the bag up, and you mail it off to them. And in about 2 weeks, you'll get a hard copy report, and they will make recommendations which ones they think are the best ones for you based on their DNA mapping, which ones are second best, third best, and like that. And I've had suicidal teenagers that were so depressed and nothing worked. And, you know, we had to basically keep them on one-on-one, you know, supervision all the time. And we tried multiple antidepressants, and they came back and they gave us an antidepressant that her psychiatrist and myself would have never given to her, because it in our experience, it wasn't very efficacious for most of our patients. So with somebody that suicidal, we never would have done it. We gave it to that young lady, and literally she calls me 3 hours later saying, "This is what normal feels like. This is amazing. How come
kidding.
Y'all didn't do this before?" No, seriously.
So again, for our listeners, the meds are going directly to the science of the brain and where it may or may not have sufficient. So they're SRIs then, or what have you, the need is. And
yes.
So there's no tinkering or guessing. It's
exactly.
It's more.
Exactly.
That's I haven't even heard of that. Not that I'm the
it's
expert on
less
everything.
Than three. It's like 3 or 4 years old. There's just the two. I think there's a third company now that's doing it. But
wow.
You know,
so
and one. Yeah.
I was just going to say, for our listeners, if you're suffering and you haven't been able to get some remedy with your healthcare professional, you've just learned something right now. DNA testing for psychotropics.
Exactly. And, you know, unfortunately, it's so new. Nobody's paying for it. You got to pay for it yourself. It's about $300. But if you've got someone who's suicidal, you're suicidal, or you've been fighting depression for years and nothing seems to work, man, $300 is nothing to pay to figure out what you need.
To give you your freedom. But I can't believe you're saying that there was that dramatic of a difference within 3 hours.
It was for this young lady. And I was just floored. And yeah.
How wonderful. That must be one of those moments like, yeah, it's all worth it doing what I do.
Exactly. Because we bang our heads up against walls all the time. Why isn't this working? Why aren't they doing what we're at? And then all of a sudden you got somebody and it's working and it's that's why we're here.
So this Joseph James D'Angelo, I understand that he's a divorced father of three daughters. And then, mm-hmm. as you mentioned, he was a police officer. So on the surface, he appeared to lead a normal life. What is that like for somebody who has a double life? Is that just business as usual for a psychopath? Or, I mean, what kind of coping do they have to go through, or manipulation or twisting to be able to appear, quote, normal? And of course, they're not. They're aberrant.
Right. And it's all a means to an end. It's just part of what they do. And, you know, it's interesting with him because he stopped. It was just like, boom, no more violence. But he did obviously follow up with the harassment and like that. But he just went kind of cold turkey. But if you look at violent, and when I do risk assessment for violence, we know that when somebody gets about 50, their risk for violence drops off dramatically and they pretty much stop. Part of it is, and when you're 18, 19 years old, crawling into somebody's, you know, bedroom window or fighting somebody outside a bar, it's not a big deal. But as you get older, you can't recover like that. You're not 18 anymore. And it, you know, that 6 foot drop outside that window is significant at 50. Whereas, you know, like I said, at 18, 19, 20 years of age, it's nothing. So him stopping cold turkey like that, actually, I don't think was unusual. What was unusual, I think, was that he went 10 years without being caught. Mm-hmm. And that is where having been a police officer and having those great social skills, at that point for a sociopath, people are just tools for you to do what you want to do and for you to get what you want.
They also said he was meticulous with his stalking and surveillance in that he would identify a potential victim and then he would know the rhythm of the household and who lived there and what their schedule was, and he would let himself in and leave Twine for the time that he was going to come back to have the crimes. And then the fact that he would eat their food while he was doing that, he even cut open a dog who was a German Shepherd who was barking. He cut open the belly. It didn't kill the dog. 70 stitches later, they said. Wow. But he stopped at nothing, including when it escalated to couples. So he originally targeted single women living by themselves, mm-hmm. in single family dwellings, and then it went to couples. And of those 12 murders, there were several couples that he killed. And that was the other thing, is that when he would tie up, he would have the female tie up the male, and then he would take her into another room to assault her, and he'd put dishes on the body of the male and say, if I hear those dishes fall, I'm killing both of you, which would keep the man quiet. And obviously,
right. 'cause,
yeah, and apparently one time one man did, and he killed both of them.
Well, you know, and that's one of the things when you have a psychopath or a social killer or a sociopath and they say they're going to do that, that's they're not lying to you. That's the plan, you know. So it's pretty dramatic. But he was trained. He was a police officer. He knew exactly how to do that, how to follow people, how to follow their rhythms, figure out when they're most vulnerable, when they're at their peak, and he shouldn't approach them because they're going to be able to fight back or they'll be able to identify him. I mean, that's what police officers look at to help fight crime. Mm-hmm. So he was trained completely how to do that. And, you know, you talked about him cutting a dog open. You know, that, you know, how many people out there that, you know, they may not like humans, but they love dogs. And how many people look at their pets and see how their pets interact with other people to determine if they're okay to even have around as people, mm-hmm. you know? So, I mean, one of the trademarks, there's a thing called the triad of mm-hmm. behaviors that are not telling. In other words, they won't say you are going to be a psychopath or a serial killer, but almost every single serial killer in history has had these three things: a fascination with fire or fire starting, cruelty to animals, and bedwetting past the developmentally appropriate age.
I guess if we would ever know, but yet that triad, and it's also called the Machiavellian triad too.
Yes.
Where there's some personality issues involved with that too. I don't know that our listeners knew that, but I'm glad that you shared that, because it's uncanny how it is almost conclusive.
It is almost conclusive. We're seeing some other things too that are following in recent history. If we look at psychopaths that also do like mass shootings, whether it's in a school or in a business, and we're finding out that almost all the serial killers had this too, and that was kind of an absentee father. You know, father may have been there, but he wasn't involved in raising that child, or the parent. That male parent was just absent. And we have hundreds of thousands, probably millions of people who were raised by mothers alone. So what we know is that it's not just that. There's something wrong with the individual who becomes that serial killer. And we're still trying to figure out who that is and what that is.
Can you speak to our listeners a little bit about the disorder which is under 18, which is like oppositionally defiant, and then how that can lead into something as an adult that's even more severe in its behavior and the acting out?
Well, you know, usually we end up with one of two things at the beginning: either conduct disorder, which evolves into oppositional defiant, or the oppositional defiant, and then we get police involvement at that point. And when there's police involvement, then they reach the age of 18, then they technically essentially have all the requirements to meet that antisocial personality disorder, which then it can fester and grow and become very extreme. In some cases, there have been historically some, you know, if we look at Jeffrey Dahmer, you know, he was doing these things still in high school. He wasn't even 18. And in fact, he got pulled over by a police officer for having a tail light out. And he reported that he had a body cut up in a plastic bag in the back seat. And he was drunk and was lucky the police officer didn't ask him to step out of the car because he couldn't stand up. But he was able to talk his way out of that tail light ticket. And the police officer let him go. If they, you know, it would have stopped him at 16 or 17 at that point. So it's an amazing thing to think about this. And if you look at some of the researchers, Reed Malloy, he talks about this whole thing being a manifestation of behaviors that start within the first 6 to 12 weeks of life, and the appropriate social connections are never made for this person during an appropriate developmental window that can close anywhere around 9 to 21 years of age. So if the right interactions happen with these people, we can stop that psychopathy from happening. But what exactly is that? Everybody's different. We don't really have that picture specifically. And we look at things like, what do they truly love? And if they start giving you objects, oh, I love my car. And if you want to see somebody who, maybe you're dating somebody who has this amazing car and they let their friends put you down and all that kind of stuff, but the minute somebody jokes about his car, he's ready to fight. That's a red flag if you're dealing with a sociopath and somebody you probably shouldn't be involved in a personal relationship with.
So you outlined what it is that we need to be concerned about. And I thought it would be valuable for our listeners to know that something that manifests itself while an individual is young can then grow into something that's severe when they're an adult, as you so
yes.
outlined, but that there are interventions that can be helpful or actually game changers so that it's not a curse that is destined to become,
that you're doomed. Yes,
right.
Yes.
So because I always try to look for the hope in things.
You know? Well, they need to attach to another human being and a deep emotional attachment. And historically it's typically a parent, But it doesn't have to be. It can be an uncle, an older sibling. It can be a school teacher. You know, all of a sudden, that person who you don't want to let down when you're doing, when your report card comes out. And, you know, I worked in schools for 20 years. I talked to teachers who tell me about people who just weren't motivated, and they somehow connected in third or fourth grade with that kid. And they're telling me stories about them coming almost every year all the way to graduation and showing them their report card, looking for those accolades from that teacher because it was that significant to them. And that's a significant connection. Maybe it's a deacon at your church, your preacher. You know, it can be anybody, but they need to make that attachment and realize that human beings are valuable for an intrinsic reason, not just as tools to get what you want out of life.
So if there's not the attachment, say, in the family of origin, for whatever reason, you're right, suggesting that coaches and, like you said, pastors or mentors or role models or community, whatever, they can help make the difference in somebody's life who is missing that attachment.
Significantly, yes, that is exactly right.
So back to Joseph James D'Angelo. Do you see him as being unique at all, or is what he did fairly what it is to be a serial killer?
I think he's very unique. I mean, I hate to say this, but, you know, I've looked at, you know, from Madame Popov over in Russia back in, you know, in the early 1900s, who ran a brothel, and she would find, you know, these her ladies of the evening would get beat up by certain people, and they would do research and find out that those people were also abusing their wives, and they would go to the wives, and then they would set this guy up and then kill him in the brothel, and killed close to 400 men like that were violent and aggressive. That's a very unique thing. But if you study all these things over history, all these people, I think he's very unique. The fact that he actually was a police officer, wasn't just doing, you know, police brutality kind of thing. He was clandestine, behind the scenes, very much stalking, planning, methodical. And I mean, that's scary because he had all the inside information, and he also was the perpetrator. So he could figure out ways to avoid capture. And it's not surprising that an outside situation brought him to capture. It had nothing to do with his normal police procedures. He protected himself.
So one of the things they mentioned about him, too, is he always blindfolded the victims. And then after he committed the crimes, he would stay quiet. And if they thought he had left, they would start to move, and he would remind them that he was still in the room.
Oh.
So, I mean, so I don't know what
that's so
is.
Eerie.
Yeah, so that then they would be afraid to moving forward, which would ensure his escape, because they would sometimes wait 3 hours before they moved again. And by that time, he was long gone. But so what is it about that, I mean, that's, what would you describe that behavior as?
Well, what people need to realize is rape is not about the sex. It is about power and control. And that is an ultimate control. I mean, he is sitting there after he actually did it, because he can do it to you. He did his homework, and he was able to manipulate and set the stage, and he did that to you. And then when you're coming to some kind of calmness and getting your wits about you and realizing what happened and processing, he's sitting there and basically pouring salt in that wound. And that is going to be such a long-term effect. We talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. Those individuals, he just poured fuel on that. And I bet to this day, if there's darkness or any kind of potential for having their eyes closed, and like that, they totally are not willing to do that. And I don't blame them. That freaks me out. I mean, because I know I've worked with so many people, that is evil to the core.
Exactly. So then the other thing is, how is it anatomically possible to rape somebody when you've got all of this adrenaline going and there's not, I mean, how does that, does the per, perverseness of the human being allow someone to get an erection?
Oh, the erection isn't about sex. It is about the power. They're turned on by the power.
So the scenario itself is the aphrodisiac, not the act of having sex.
Not the act of having. In fact, you know, we've tried in the past to use chemical castration. And what happens is the people use a hairbrush or a broom handle. They'll use anything to rape the person. It's about the power. I mean, there's videos of Ted Bundy discussing his hunting these girls down and killing them. And when he stands up, it's obvious he's got an erection after talking about watching them die in his hands. It's the power.
So is there anything that we can do? I mean, not this is obviously the exception. And I mean, I was right around in Southern California because he made his way from the Bay Area and the Sacramento area down to the Santa Barbara area into Ventura County, which is actually where I live. And the one of the husband-wife murders was in Ventura County. And it's kind of reviving. Like the district attorney from Sacramento said, she was maybe 12, 13, 14 when this was all going down. Mm-hmm. And it's almost eerie for her to think that now under her purview and during her tenure, she's actually bringing this man to, you know, I guess we should keep saying alleged, right? Because he's alleged to have done these things. Alleged.
Correct.
Yes.
You want to get technical about it? Yes.
Yeah. So, and she said it wasn't her vendetta or anything that she, 'cause I listened to the press conference, that she didn't go about finding it. It just so happened that it's under her, you know, care, custody and control and under her watch. And but she does remember it. So a lot of us in California not only remember this, but I was around when the I forget Richard Ramirez was doing his thing. And that was actually where I was living. And I remember people leaving the lights on. Well, the doors got locked when they didn't used to be. Purses got put away when they used to be in plain sight. I mean, we changed our behaviors because that was going on. And I wonder, you don't want to live in fear, but you also don't want to be stupid.
Right. And look how much power that person inflicted, even on people who weren't directly their victims.
Right. So I don't know it's what the lesson is here.
Well, there's several lessons. And, you know, and it's hard because I don't want people living in fear. I don't want my children living in fear. But I can tell you my son's a second degree black belt. My daughter's almost a black belt. And she doesn't want to do it. She doesn't want to study it. And I'm like, you know, I know you don't want to, but you're going to until you get your black belt and then you're done. And, you know, she doesn't know what I do. I don't walk in and say, hey, look at this crime scene that I'm looking at for the police department, you know. But I worry. I mean, but I don't want my family living in fear. Okay. My wife's a black belt. I'm almost a third degree black belt. But there were other stimuli for me. I did an assessment of a serial killer in a Florida jail, and we went on lockdown just as I finished. And we were on lockdown for 5 hours. So I was stuck in this little closet space for almost 8 hours with this individual, and all I kept thinking about is, you know, nobody's come by to check on me.
Can tell us more about that. That's frightening.
Well, you know, it is frightening, but the fact is he was a gentleman because he has such good social skills, and knew that my report was going back to a judge, and he didn't want to do anything to make my report bad that might keep him in jail longer. So he was a gentleman. I mean, he was excited, I think, to talk to somebody who, you know, slept outside in the free world last night. I mean, he was asking me about restaurants, you know, how much is a steak this time now, you know, and he used to go to this restaurant and it was this much. I mean, very social. It was almost pleasant if I didn't know what was going on with him mentally and psychologically.
And he was a serial killer?
Been a very fun thing. Yes, ma'am.
And what did you decide about him?
You know, I mean, I just finished up the report. It wasn't even that significant. Nothing I didn't expect. And I sent it on to the judge. And as far as I know, he's still incarcerated.
And why is it that they didn't check on you?
Well, because they were trying to get a head count and find all the inmates. And usually when they lock down, that means they've miscounted somebody or somebody's escaped. And I you know, I had been in that prison several times before, testing other people, and never had a problem with anybody. And I don't know, you know, I never approached anybody and said, "Hey, what's going on?" You know, at that time I was already doing things to protect myself. I would wear a tie, but it had a snap in the back of it instead of one long. So if somebody grabbed my tie to try to pull me down or something, it would just come unsnapped, that type of thing. You know, we have drawings and things they do as, you know, you're studying psychology and being becoming a psychologist, and you talk about the Wechsler IQ tests and the MMPI and then the House Tree Person. You start having drawing things. You give them, you know, 10-inch pencils. Do I really want to give a serial killer a 10-inch pencil that could go right through my neck? So I give them golf pencils, so only about 3/4 of an inch. So they have to really hit that carotid artery to do that. So
so I hope the listeners, you could get an appreciation, Dr. Huber, like you're thinking about what they might do, worst case scenario. Not most people, when they go to work, have to think about that. Will I survive this experience or not?
You know, and I get asked that, how do you handle that? Well, I don't go into prison every day. That's first of all. But they're like, how do you handle it in general? Well, and it's actually kind of easy, because I know everybody there is potentially violent, so I don't let my guard down with anybody. I keep my back to the wall. I have guards around me. If I do have to turn my back to an inmate, that there's a guard there that is, you know, typically armed of some way, either, you know, stun gun or something like that, so they can at least warn me if something's happening. I've never had a problem there. What I get stressed out about is going on to a regular high school campus, because all the kids there know who the violent kids are, but the adults don't usually. And I don't know if I turn my back on that group of kids, if that isn't a violent kid over there in that group that's going to come get me. That's where it's kind of tenuous, because I don't want them to feel like I'm treating them like prison inmates, because 99.9% of those kids are fine. It's that 0.1% that I worry about.
It's a random.
That's it?
Yeah. So is there something, a tool that our listeners, because, you know, now they're talking about if you see something, say something, especially with TSA and that sort of thing. If because these people are as engaging and charismatic, as you suggested earlier on in our discussion, is there something that we might be able to notice that this could be potential for warning?
If things just don't seem to add up, if you talk to somebody and they eventually, or in very few minutes, maybe in less than an hour, they get you to tell your whole life story to them, and you feel very comfortable with them. Yet you sit there and you go, wait, I don't even know this person's last name. Forget about where they went to high school or what kind of job they do. You know, and then if all you've heard is superficial information from them, those are red flags. But it could also be that, you know, people like you and me, I mean, we're putting ourselves out in public, and I don't necessarily want to know where everybody, or want everybody to know where my kids go to school. Because if somebody gets mad at me, I mean, I'm talking about a lot of people out there who are psychopaths, who have a history of harming people. And, you know, that makes me vulnerable, makes my family vulnerable. So I don't go out and say, hey, I live in this building and, you know, my office is there. My kids go to that school and they travel here and this is where they walk to school. That would be ridiculous for me to do that. I don't think anybody else should be doing that either, regardless of whether they talk about serial killers or other violent offenders in general, period.
And before we finish, I'd like you to share about mainstream mental health and mainstreammentalhealth.org, what it is and why you created it and what you hope to accomplish with it and what you have done through it.
Well, one of the things that manifest is I don't just spend all my time working with violent people. I have an actual practice and I see patients and we talk about their relationships with their spouses and their kids, and I see kids and their issues with their friends. And I also have privileges at two hospitals that are not mental health hospitals, they're medical hospitals. And we get patients in there who have to deal with severe medical issues, potential death cases. A lot of them are told, hey, you're dying, and there's nothing we can do about it. And they write a referral to me. Or we have to amputate your leg because you have gangrene in this joint, and there's no antibiotics for gangrene. If we don't cut it off, you're going to die. And I get a phone call or I get a message from the charge nurse, hey, you have a new referral. And I go in there, and probably 95% of the time I get something like, hey, I'm not crazy. You know, why are you here? You're the last person I want to see. And they're afraid. The stigma of mental health. I've had patients tell me, oh, so you give me a diagnosis of depression. Now they're going to lock me up in the loony bin. And I'm like, excuse me, you know, loony bin is such an archaic term, you know, it goes back to lunatic, and you're not a lunatic, are you? And it's crazy, but they're afraid because we have created so much social stigma. And everybody says, oh, that person's crazy. Why else would they go shoot up this? Or why would they go do that crime? And so all of a sudden we started merging mental health issues in a layman's minds to being violent, when in fact most people with mental health issues are victims 99% of the time, and only about 1% of the time are they perpetrators. So you have a question.
Yeah, I was going to say, because when we think about mental health, sometimes people think of that as a chronic situation, somebody who's talking to themselves, who has psychosis, or, you know, has visions and that sort of thing. But I think, and perhaps correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Huber, that mental health challenges can also mean situational feelings that are appropriate, i.e. a divorce, a loss of a child, a serious medical diagnosis, depression, that while it's considered a mental health challenge, it doesn't mean that it's chronic. It doesn't mean that it's permanent. It doesn't mean that you're less than a person. It just means at the moment you're having some intense emotions. And what can we do about that?
And exactly, that is exactly right. And there's no reason why you shouldn't let us help you treat it, just like you let us treat the cold or the flu or diabetes or cancer.
Right.
Let us do our job and you'll get through this a lot more efficiently. In fact, with some of these mental health issues that pop up, like depression, your body starts releasing cortical steroids and slowing down your healing process and weakening your immune system. So we're actually helping you get out of the hospital earlier if you let us work with you.
Right.
And we've seen it. We've documented it in the hospitals I'm at. But what happens is I go back into my dictation room with the other physicians and we're talking. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, this person was so upset. And I had, you know, it took me 45 minutes to teach them that it's not a crazy thing. It's a human thing. And that they're actually normal for feeling depressed because they've been in the hospital for 3 months.
Right.
You know, it's not that they're crazy. They're normal. And so the doctors finally said, after about 4 or 5 years of me going in there, said, you know, you either need to do something about this or stop complaining about it. So I created Mainstream Mental Health because I want mental health to be mainstream, not something we keep in a dark alley. So that's why I did it. And, you know, in the past year, we have actually almost 2 years now, we have gotten a lot of attention. We've been in everything from actually the National Enquirer to the Huffington Post to Washington Post. We've been all over U.S. News and World Report. We've been mentioned on almost 2,000 now nationally radio syndicated, national syndicated radio shows, almost 2,000 interviews, been on national television several times talking exactly about these same topics. And at this point, I'm on a show called America Trends, which is in 160 networks nationwide. Once a week, I go on the air and we talk about mental health issues. And they vary, you know, it's whatever the show wants me to talk about. We talk about mental health related topics, whether it's prom night and what if your, you know, boyfriend or girlfriend breaks up with you right before prom? How do you deal with that kind of stuff? How does a parent deal with it? All the way to when the Austin bomber was going around here in Central Texas, blowing people up, what to do, what not to do, and how to anticipate what is going to be safe for you and your family and that type of stuff.
So to paraphrase, mainstream mental health then, as I understand it, is to destigmatize mental health issues and challenges.
Yes, you're using those big words, though. And that is exactly what it is. And along with that, I believe that life is way too short not to find something to smile about. And because of that, we use comedy. We actually have a fundraiser coming up in September at Capital City Comedy Club here in Austin, Texas. Last year, we were blessed. Rob Reiner actually showed up to it. It was a great event.
Wow.
And so we're doing it again this September. And it looks like I'm actually going to be in at the comic strip on June 9th in New York City. So,
what's
and they're
that
doing
about?
Well, they're doing a comedy event just like we're doing, but it's for Habitat for Humanity. It's for the puppies and what is that? I can't.
The ASPCA.
It's not PETA. It's one of the other ones, but it's
like
statewide there in New York.
Okay.
Yes, and I'm going to be up there, and they heard about it, and so they asked me if I would come up on stage and talk a little bit about mental health and use my humor like I do at our show.
So. Which, can you speak just a little bit before we run out of time? Because you mentioned healing physically along with healing mentally, and what your thoughts are about mindfulness in that regard.
Well, your body is a machine, and it's not just a bunch of mechanical gears. It is run by a central processing unit, just like your computer is, actually like your air conditioning unit is. You got that little processor on the wall there that tells your air conditioner when to turn on and things like that. And when our brain isn't working right, our body doesn't work right. And you may think everything's going along fine, but if you're sad, you're a little depressed, you don't feel motivated to do things, there's a lot of interference with that machine we have as a body. And it could be neurotransmitters, it could be your hormones, it can be, you know, even chronic pain sufferers. And there's some amazing research out there on chronic pain and how that creates depression. And you may learn to deal with that chronic pain and then never get over your depression. So that taints your life, the rest of your life, unless you get help and intervention for that. So it is all, it's not either or, brain or body. It is the whole thing. They both affect each other. You have to stay sharp. That's why I do the martial arts. In fact, where I go, I'm trained in Korean, so I have to focus on what's being said because my Korean is pretty bad. So if I don't stay focused and say, start thinking about one of my clients earlier in the day, or if I had a patient who died, or, you know, whatever's going on, a suicide attempt, something like that, if I don't focus on that class, then, you know, I usually end up on my backside because somebody let me have it. So it kind of forces you to stop worrying about what's outside that moment. And I think we live in a linear timeline when we're not actually in a linear time world. We're in the present. There's really no future or past. It's right now. Mm-hmm. Now, you can prepare for the future, but you don't know what's going to happen in the future. And the only real control we have is how we react to what's going on at this moment. And if we stop looking at life like a linear thing, we stop worrying about that mistake you made last week, you know, and you start thinking about how can I make today the best possible day I can have. And it sounds cheesy. I understand that. But the reality of it is it works.
Well, and I always say that we're arrogant if we think we have anything more than this moment.
So true. So true. And, you know, as a psychologist, we don't often see that. But since I've been in the hospitals and I have patients, I've had patients while I'm talking to them code and die right in front of me, where 3 minutes before they were perfectly normal. I mean, there was nothing that appeared to be wrong with them, and their body just decided to turn off at that moment. Mm-hmm. And it makes you change your whole perspective on things. You know, now I come home and my wife has changed a lot too. But at first, you know, our kids were in school and I would get these panics and all that kind of stuff, you know, panic messages. And I would get home and I go, and everybody's going crazy. And I'm like, okay, who's dying? Well, nobody. And we can deal with it. Let's figure out, let's get a game plan. Let's just stop panicking.
Let's put this in perspective.
Exactly.
I always call those are details of life.
That's exactly right.
Challenges are deciding chemo or radiation and which order and all of that.
That's so true.
I cannot thank you enough, Dr. Huber, for joining us again. And again, it's mainstreammentalhealth.org and clinical forensic psychology, Dr. John Huber. Thank you for sharing such great light on the entire conversation, not just with Joseph James DeAngelo, but with mental health in general.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. And anytime you want me on, I'm ready.
Thank you. Thank you. And we want to thank you again, listeners, Maria Sanchez. And we're missing Senator Michael D. Brown, but he'll be back next week. And we thank you so much for making us a part of your day. Have a great week. Until next Sunday.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.